From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The men are marching toward madness, and the women are wacko as well. Ahead on Only a Game, college hoopsters prepare for hardwood hysteria. Also, the Saints of tiny St. Lawrence University go for glory in the women's Frozen Four, and athletes in Yellowknife, snowshoe, high kick, sledge jump, curl, pole push, and knuckle hop at the 20th Arctic Games. Also ahead, to the detriment of Dodger Town denizens, the Dodgers get out of Dodger Town.
It's kind of like that movie Field of Dreams, where you just have the imprints of all those past players of Brooklyn days. For another team to come in, it's just not the same.
Instead of them disappearing into the cornfield, they're disappearing into the orange groves.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Few basketball teams can lose two significant players to injury without stumbling at least a little. That will be the challenge the women's team at the University of Connecticut will be facing when the NCAA tournament gets underway a week from today. North Carolina, Tennessee, Stanford, and Maryland are among the teams preparing to take advantage of the somewhat hobbled Huskies, unless, of course, it turns out that they're not hobbled at all, since they've lost exactly one game all season. Joining me now to discuss women's college hoops as the orchestra tunes up for the big dance is Michelle Smith, who covers the game for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Kalana Green and Mel Thomas are the two players UConn lost to injury, but freshman Maya Moore has taken up a lot of the slack, and Chardy Houston has returned from forgotten-on-the-bench status. Is UConn just so deep that even injuries can't hurt them?
They're very, very good and very deep. Yeah, I mean, the injuries, they would be obviously a lot better with those players in the lineup, but they haven't missed much. They've lost just the one game. This is a really, really good UConn team. Maya Moore is phenomenal for a freshman. I mean, she's getting votes for National Player of the Year. She's, you know, may steal a few votes from Candace Parker at Tennessee, and that alone is remarkable. I mean, she's the real deal, and she came in and made a huge impact.
Rutgers, highly regarded all season, lost by a great many to Connecticut at the end of the regular season. Then they lost in the quarterfinals of the Big East tournament to Louisville, which hasn't been ranked in the top 20. It would be fun to see Coach Stringer win her first championship in the same year that she got her 800th win, but how likely is that?
Well, they're also hobbled by injury. I mean, they have two players, I think, who've gone. They've got Maya McMurdy was out. They've got Khadija Rushen. I mean, they've got injuries as well. I mean, and this was not a very deep team to begin with. So I think the issue with Rutgers is and has been that those couple of injuries that they've picked up toward the end of the year really hurt them because they're not a deep team. So, I think Rutgers is on a bit of shaky ground at the moment. It would be great to see them make a big run. But, you know, they've got some making up to do with some kids that are not able to play for them now.
Oklahoma is another team that suffered an upset in their conference tournament. They lost to unranked Missouri. Oklahoma still has Courtney Paris, but have they got enough else to go anywhere next week?
Well, they have Ashley Paris as well, who's having a nice season, but hurt Courtney's twin.
Mm-hmm.
That is a team that is got, you know, it's Courtney Paris and everybody else right now on that team. They're not getting enough from their supporting players, not anywhere close. They're going to go into the tournament on a three-game losing streak, and that's not momentum. They've battled it out. The Big 12 has been a battleground all year, those teams just beating up on each other and beating each other every time you turn around. And I think it's a tough year for Oklahoma.
Much as it will discourage fans in other parts of the country than the East, I have to go back to UConn for a minute because, once again, they're going to get the consensus best high school player in the country next season when Elena Deladon arrives on campus in the fall. Should the NCAA make a rule against every high school player of the year enrolling at Connecticut?
Gino can sell it, can he? I mean, absolutely. You know, this is... It's a nice run for him. They're recruiting really, really well after that little dip where they weren't winning national championships and even, you know, they didn't get out of the Sweet 16 the one year 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, Gino's just hit the recruiting trail again and he's hitting it hard. And this is, you know, they've gotten the number one player in the country the last 2 or 3 years. A couple of years before that, it was Tennessee. I mean, this is the way it is. But I think that the parity across the country has shown that you get these superstar players. Maya Moore certainly has made a big impact. But, you know, there's a nice sort of a level of parity among maybe the top 8 or 9 teams in the country this year that, you know, you can get those number one players. Doesn't guarantee you anything.
Baylor captured the national championship just a few years ago, and at one point this season they had won 20 of 21 games. But since mid-February, Baylor has gone 3-4. What's happened in Waco?
Well, you know, they also had an injury, and injuries have played a huge role in some of these top teams this year. I have to confess, I saw Baylor at Stanford, and that was their one loss in that 20-game that run that they had, and they lost to Stanford by 24 points. And I wasn't sure about Baylor because I just thought, I just hoped that they had been better than that. And then they lost one of their key players. So I think injuries are also affecting them and that Big 12. I mean, you're talking about Kansas State, Oklahoma State, Oklahoma, Baylor, Texas A&M, you know, even Gail Gessen's course has got Texas pulling off some upsets. That is a brutal battleground to get yourself ready for the tournament.
Stanford, which you mentioned, won their conference championship final by 21 points, thereby demonstrating that they appear to be peaking at the right time. They were ranked 4th in the nation the last time I looked. Does that seem about right?
Yes. Let's talk about my girls out west. not a lot of people, as usual, will have seen them play heading into the tournament. They have a lot of good buzz because in the non-conference, they won at Rutgers. They beat up Baylor pretty good. They have beaten Utah. They have beaten Old Dominion. They beat Tennessee when Tennessee was number one. Their only loss in the non-conference was, a loss to Connecticut over in the Virgin Islands. And the Pac-10 wasn't a very good conference this year. But Stanford is playing really, really well. And Candace Wiggins is, probably one of the three best players in the country. And she's had sort of a phenomenal finish, won the Pac-10 all-time scoring titles a couple weeks ago. I like the way Stanford looks right now. They've got both the inside and the outside. They're playing really well.
Michelle, we have talked pretty much exclusively about contenders or near contenders, I guess because historically the women's tournament has not been kind to long shots. Any chance this year's dance could be the exception?
That's really hard because you're dealing with home courts in women's basketball that you're not dealing with other play in the men's game. You know, even if you've put in a bid to host, you could still be hosting on your home court. That's certainly, we've got a Stanford situation where Stanford's hosting its games this time because it put in the bid for it. The women's basketball is just much, much harder to come out of nowhere. Middle Tennessee was kind of a dark horse last year. It was everybody's favorite. I'm not sure they're getting into the tournament this year. Florida State was the team that knocked Stanford out last year. I'm not sure they're getting into the tournament. It's hard to sustain it, and to be a one-hit wonder in the women's tournament is not something that usually happens.
Michelle Smith covers women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks very much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
This weekend, the 8 best women's college hockey teams will compete for spots in the Frozen Four tournament. St. Lawrence University, a small rural college in northern New York, is once again chasing a national championship. With an enrollment of just 2,000, St. Lawrence has held its own against traditional Ivy League powerhouses and big state programs like Wisconsin and Minnesota. Though they've come up a bit short the last 4 seasons, the Saints are hoping to win it all this year. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
This is a story that begins a year ago in the first round of the Women's Frozen Four tournament in Lake Placid, New York. The St. Lawrence Saints, then ranked number 2 in the country, were on the ice, facing the top-ranked Wisconsin Badgers. But right from the start, the Saints looked off balance. As their shot at the national championship slipped away, Saints fan Francine Peretta watched in dismay.
They just don't seem to be clicking. They're passing to nobody.
The Badgers won decisively, and Saints junior forward Sabrina Harbeck, who hails from Saint-Hubert, Quebec, could barely contain her disgust after the loss.
We couldn't settle down like we always do. I don't know, maybe we're too nervous. We tried to force a pass or force a shot, and they were really good to block shots.
It was the Saints' 4th shot at the Frozen Four in as many years, and for the 4th time they had come up short. If there was a consolation for Coach Paul Flanagan, it was the fact that the core of his Saints team was coming back.
Our kids thrive on the fact that we're in the hunt, we're in the pursuit of this thing pretty much every year, and we take a lot of pride in that.
A year later, much of that promise has been fulfilled. In a week when all but 8 teams have packed it in, the Saints are still on the ice, getting ready for another run at the postseason. Team leader Annie Gay, a defenseman from Rouyn-Noranda, Quebec, shrugged stubbornly at the idea that her team hasn't been able to close the deal on a national championship.
All I know is that losing maybe in those 3 years, that we don't have any regrets and we left it all out on the ice.
But co-captain Sabrina Harbeck, who's famous in the U.S. and Canada for her aggressive play, admits that there's a feeling here of unfinished business.
I saw you right after the Frozen Four defeat last year, and you looked pretty wrecked.
Yes, it was a tough loss. Some bad plays, some few mistakes there, and we lost the game. And you worked so hard for it, so of course it's really frustrating. Like, it's been 3 years in a row for Annie and I, so hopefully she will be the right one.
A win this year would also be a huge recruiting windfall for the Saints program. St. Lawrence University sits in Canton, New York, a rural town smack on the Canada border. The campus is surrounded by hayfields and dairy farms, and the closest city is Ottawa, Ontario, 90 minutes away over snow-swept two-lane roads. Coach Paul Flanagan says the small town culture has been a big draw for athletes recruited from little towns in Vermont and Alberta and Saskatchewan.
We go to the VFW after Friday night's games and mill around with the townspeople. They don't get that at other schools.
But the Saints are competing for top recruits against Ivy League schools and against colleges with 20 times the enrollment. Without a national championship, Flanagan says finding top athletes willing to come here is a growing challenge.
It's becoming probably more and more of an issue, finding the last couple of years with a big school mentality. We're kind of off the beaten path for a lot of kids.
On this afternoon, the Saints are skirmishing hard, banging each other against the boards. Their home rink, Appleton Arena, has an old-fashioned feel, with tiers of hardwood bleachers rising like church pews. Just last weekend, the team pushed top-ranked Harvard into overtime in the ECAC tournament, only to fall short once again to a top team. Harbeck and Gay say they're searching for a way to elevate their game without tightening up.
Even if we lost against Harvard last Sunday, knowing that we can play against the number one team in the country, it's really good for us. It was good for our confidence.
It didn't turn out our way, but it for sure made us stronger. And I think much better prepared for this upcoming weekend.
With six seniors graduating this year, including Harbeck and Gay, the pressure is on for the Saints to finally pull out some upsets. But whatever happens, Annie Gay says not to count out the little school that thinks it can.
It's such a small school, and I think we're, like, the cohesion is so strong. I think that's what makes us unique.
The sixth-ranked Saints play number 3 New Hampshire today in Durham. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Canton, New York.
Nestling neath the purple shadows of the Adirondack Hills lies our noble alma mater, thoughts of whom our memory fills. To her we bow in reverence.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If you anticipate that spending hour after hour in front of the TV watching college basketball over the next few weeks might not go over too well with your significant other, and if you're a guy, you might want to consider a suggestion from the Oregon Urology Institute. The clinic's radio commercial suggests that anybody needing an excuse to stay glued to televised hoops should, quote, get your vasectomy at Oregon Urology Institute the day before the tournament starts. And then it puckishly adds, it's Snip City. The sports radio station broadcasting the ads offered each patient sports magazines, free pizza, and a bag of frozen peas. Don't ask. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, integrated baseball in Mexico, well before Jackie Robinson suited up for the Dodgers. But first, the Dodgers departed Brooklyn 50 years ago, but odes are still written to the former bums. Songs dedicated to the memories of Jackie, Campy, and the Duke are still sung. As if to solemnize that semicentennial, the Dodgers are preparing to depart their longtime spring training home, Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports from Vero Beach, Florida.
Get your programs and scorecards here. Take one home as a memory. Line up for today. Got to have one, right?
Welcome to Dodger Town, a name to which this spring training complex can lay claim only a little longer, and where the ticket office has been especially busy this spring.
Yeah, we come all the way from California just to get tickets.
The ticket agent hearing this tale wears a home plate-shaped patch on her shirt commemorating the Dodgers' 60-year stay at this former naval air base. But the Dodgers are moving on to a new spring training home in Glendale, Arizona, a half century after they relocated from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. Craig Callen, the Dodgers' vice president of spring training in minor league facilities, knows what his team is leaving behind this time.
History, tradition, just walking around Dodger Town, seeing Jackie Robinson Drive, Tommy Lasorda Lane, Vin Scully Way, all of these Hall of Famers, and these are the original fields that Jackie and Campy practice on. And it's hard to leave something that is basically in baseball hollow grounds.
At 5,000-seat Holman Stadium, the globes of the streetlights look like baseballs. The PA system still plays Take the A-Train, and the chain-link fence in the outfield leaves an unrestricted view for the general admission crowd lounging on blankets and folding chairs on the grassy slope behind it. At one time, there was no fence until too many outfielders chasing down fly balls crashed into the palm trees ringing the field. Vero Beach resident Dick Crago, the Dodgers' PA announcer here for the past 40 years, says Dodger Town has long offered a different kind of baseball experience.
This was the smallest venue where a major league team trained, and because of its smallness, players didn't feel the need of isolating themselves quite so much, and it used to be that we would see them in our movies and in our churches and things of that sort. Back before the new headquarters building was built, the players had to walk about a quarter of a mile from the dressing room to the field. And at that point, people could come up and talk to them, and it was a real nice thing for them to be able to do that.
Hall of Fame pitcher and Dodger legend Sandy Koufax still makes quiet visits from his Vero Beach home to work with the team's young pitchers. And today, in an annual rite of spring, all the current Dodgers have assembled on the field to greet fans and sign autographs before taking on the Mets. 76-year-old Bill DeLore, who started in the Dodgers' mailroom and worked his way up to become the team's traveling secretary, is spending his 45th spring training here. He has a special fondness for Dodger Town.
You can walk in the dining room and be sitting next to the general manager and having lunch, and the next day be sitting next to the mailboy having lunch. So it wasn't separated by your position in the organization. Everybody was equal, and that's what made it so unique.
As the Dodgers' departure date approaches, there's been no shortage of memories. Steve Garvey, who starred at first base in the 1970s and 80s, has just written a book chronicling his days as a bat boy here, a prelude to arriving as a player 10 years later.
Originally, when I came here in the spring of 69, it was the barracks and an army blanket and two pillows and a sheet, and there'd be eight guys to a room, and you'd look up on the ceiling, and there'd be spiders walking around, and at 7 in the morning, an older gentleman would blow the whistle, and you'd get up, and you'd gather your stuff and walk through the orange groves and go to the dining hall, and you'd eat and practice from 8 to 4 or 5 and have dinner and fool around for a little while and go to bed and get up and do it the next day. And that was the charm of it. In this wonderful setting, everything was self-contained here.
The Dodgers eventually built a more modern motel-style compound that still houses their minor leaguers. But in Arizona, the team will share a new $80 million state-of-the-art baseball complex with the Chicago White Sox. Tommy Lasorda, the 80-year-old former Dodger pitcher, manager, and executive, adds that for the past 40 years, Los Angeles has been the only West Coast team to train on the East Coast, and that their latest owner, real estate magnate Frank McCourt, saw the need for change.
The McCourts are thinking about our fans back in Los Angeles. Give them the opportunity to come and see the Dodgers in the spring training. It's very difficult to come from Los Angeles to Vero Beach. But to go from Los Angeles to Phoenix, Arizona, 4 hours in a car, 40 minutes in a plane. We'll have a lot of our fans coming over there.
Many fans in Vero Beach say they understand the economic and geographical imperatives, but only to a point. At a recent game, one showed up in a T-shirt inscribed, "Now I know how Brooklyn felt."
I won't go to Arizona. After Vero Beach, I'm done.
Lifelong Dodger fan Dan Gardella has been coming down from New York for 15 years and did not take the news of his team's move well.
I was very shocked and kind of hurt by it because this place has been a baseball heaven for many fans for many, many years, where you have access to players, the memories here. There's certain things in life money can't buy, all right, and this is one of them.
Gardella was planning to retire here, but says he's changed his mind because the Dodgers changed theirs. So is Jerry Braden, who along with his wife did retire here 8 years ago. They're selling their house and moving back to Texas at the end of the month. Braden says that the Dodgers' move to Arizona loses something in translation.
You know, you can dig up home plate and take it, and you can take the street signs that say Vin Scully Way, but that's all they are, is just signs. You just can't duplicate what, you know, 60 years of tradition means to people here.
But news of the Dodgers' springtime migration isn't bad for everyone. The Baltimore Orioles may relocate here next spring, which would preserve the almost 350 jobs at Dodgertown and the estimated $30 million annual impact on the local economy. But the sound of Oriole Town just doesn't have the same ring for Connie Braden.
It's kind of like that movie Field of Dreams, where you just have the imprints of all those past players of Brooklyn days. You know, you see those old faces in your mind of how this all developed, and for another team to come in, it's just not the same. It's not what made this Dodger town.
Instead of them disappearing into the cornfield, they're disappearing into the orange groves.
The Dodgers have scripted a less romantic exit. Besides breaking their multi-year lease, they're even leaving early this spring. Half the team has already departed for a goodwill tour of China, and those Dodgers left behind have just two more games at Vero Beach, including their finale Monday against the Houston Astros. The two squads will reunite in Arizona, where they'll spend the rest of spring training playing their new Cactus League neighbors. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Vero Beach, Florida.
Nice!
Jackie Robinson, the first black ball player in the modern major leagues, was a pioneer. Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers when the team brought Robinson into the major league, shares the credit for Robinson's achievement. But in his new book, South of the Color Barrier, John Virtue argues that the groundwork for Rickey's great experiment was established in the Mexican League, where black, white, and Hispanic players had been sharing infields, outfields, and clubhouses for years before Robinson came to Brooklyn. John Virtue joins me now from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You maintain that from the late 30s through the middle 40s, the most important racially integrated league in baseball was the professional league in Mexico. How did it come to be that the Mexican League was integrated while Major League Baseball in the U.S. was not?
Well, the Mexicans have always had a great interest in black ball players, ball players from the United States and ball players from Cuba. When the Kansas City Monarchs played a series in Mexico in the 1930s, police had to be called to keep order outside of their hotel because the fans were anxious to get a close-up look of the players.
Most of the people who've heard of Jorge Pascal think of him as the guy who poached players from various major league teams by setting up clandestine meetings. He would go and show the players suitcases full of cash and promise them the good life south of the border if they'd fly back to Mexico with him. To what extent is that an accurate characterization?
It's only half the story. The other half is the fact that he was signing top Negro leaguers well before then. People like Roy Campanella and Monty Irvin, Josh Gibson, Ray Dandridge, Cool Papa Bell, Willie Wells, Leon Day, all members of the Hall of Fame. When he founded his team, the Veracruz Blues, in 1940, he signed 13 Negro leaguers to his team to such an extent that one of the newspapers in Veracruz dubbed the team the Veracruz Blacks.
Some of the white players who tried playing in the Mexican leagues didn't last very long, but a number of the Negro leaguers whom Pascal employed in Mexico enjoyed productive and long careers there. To what extent was life better in Mexico for guys like Josh Gibson, Ray Dandridge, Ted Double Duty Radcliffe than it was in the U.S.?
Oh, it was great. Just for example, take Ray Dandridge. He was making $10,000 a year as player manager for the Mexico City Red Devils in 1947, and he actually turned down a tryout with the Cleveland Indians because he felt loyalty to Jorge Pascal. Pascal gave him a 6-room apartment overlooking Chapultepec Park, which is the equivalent of a Fifth Avenue apartment overlooking New York Central Park, and he provided a maid to help with the housework and a tutor for the Dandridge children.
The Major League commissioners and owners regarded Jorge Pascal as at best a pest and at worst a criminal in the sense that he paid no attention to their own favorite law, which was baseball's reserve clause. But were any of Pascal's activities illegal?
No, they weren't. He considered the reserve clause a form of slavery, and when Larry McPhail of the New York Yankees launched a tampering suit against Pascal, Pascal's lawyer brought up the reserve clause, much to the surprise of organized baseball.
You quote several of the men who played in the Negro Leagues and the Mexican Leagues as saying that some of the teams in the Mexican League could have competed on even terms with the best major league clubs. Do you think they were right?
Well, they were good. It's interesting what happened in 1946. Pascal's team, the Veracruz Blues, had more major leaguers, former major leaguers in the lineup, than any team, but the one team with only one former major leaguer, and it had three Afro-Americans and four Afro-Cubans in the lineup, it ended up winning the championship. So from that point of view, you could say in 1946 in the Mexican League, the Negro leaguers bested the major leaguers.
Besides demonstrating that black men and white men could coexist as teammates and that black managers could handle teams made up of blacks, whites, and Hispanics, how did Jorge Pascal actually encourage the integration of the major leagues?
Well, he was like Branch Rickey, because Branch Rickey really didn't set out to integrate baseball. What he was looking for were the best possible players. And from that point of view, these two men righted an injustice in baseball on the way to getting better teams, and that will probably be their greatest legacy.
Based on your book, it seems that the Mexican leagues peaked while Jorge Pascal was in charge. What has happened to professional baseball in Mexico since Mr. Pascal's death in a plane crash in 1955?
Well, it no longer brings down the seasoned players as it did when baseball was segregated. With the advent of television in the late 40s, soccer replaced baseball as the most popular sport. Just because it was cheaper to play, you didn't need the elaborate equipment that baseball players do. And strangely enough, wrestling has always been one of the most popular sports in Mexico, and it might even be the number two spectator sport now.
John Virtue is the author of South of the Color Barrier, How Jorge Pascal and the Mexican League Pushed Baseball Toward Racial Integration, published by McFarland & Company. He joined me from the studios of WLRN in Miami. John, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Fine. Thank you very much for having me, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. From San Diego up to Maine, each biped with a half a brain will have their brackets to fill in, for soon the tournaments begin. I sit with pencil poised to choose which teams will win and which will lose, which favorites will be favored by the fates that, giggling from on high, will muck about with bookies' odds to break the spirits of the clods who dabble in the bracket game. That's all of us. We're all the same. The Sharpie, cousin to the kid who played for Duke or almost did, and knows the coach's neighbor's friend, will say he's sure that in the end, his brackets, he being no beginner, will show not only who's the winner, but also show, round after round, who's dead and who is glory-bound. The clown who works across the hall and don't know jack about basketball will find the fiercest mascots, then decide that it's no contest when the Bears take on the Badgers. He has no use for the fighting tree. The temp, who's typing in the lobby, basketball's his girlfriend's hobby. She's provided him with choices, but his head is full of voices urging him to go instead with teams whose uniforms are red. Green is also nice, and blue in choosing who knows what he'll do. Down the hall, behind locked doors, the boss, myopic, briskly pours herself a stiff one. She's a pal of television's Dick Vitale. She calls him, whispers, "Look, I've got to know which teams are really hot. If some goof working for me here should win the pool, I'd have to fear they might forget that I'm the boss. For should I suffer any loss of prestige at this choosing game, things here might never be the same." So outside help as well as pluck and secret dreams and dumbest luck, they'll all play parts as play begins, producing nationwide both grins and sad expressions, moping too. And so say I, good luck to you. If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club, or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Treat me like a fool, treat me mean and cruel.
Real Madrid is currently leading Spain's Premier Soccer League, but apparently team officials aren't much good at identifying American movie stars. Real's management welcomed a prankster impersonating Nicolas Cage to the club's recent Champions League game against AC Roma. The hoaxer, an Italian TV personality named Paolo Calabresi, watched the game from a box reserved for the team's directors and was escorted into the team's locker room following the match. There he was presented with a personalized Real Madrid jersey by club president Ramon Calderon. Mr. Calabresi must be a pretty good actor. Not only did he pull off the Nicolas Cage impersonation, he didn't blow his cover by cheering when AC Roma won the game.
I would beg and steal.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, cold competition and international spirit at minus 45 Celsius. Brr. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
There is much to discuss regarding men's college basketball. Let's start with the very real possibility that the 2006 and 2007 champion Florida might not be invited to the dance in 2008. What happened?
Well, they got real young real fast because they lost all their players to the NBA and parts unknown. And Billy Donovan has decided that his young people aren't quite as tough and angry and don't have the gravel in their belly that he expected them to have. So he's bad-mouthing his own team. Florida is one of dozens of teams who, after just a nightmarish Thursday, look like they don't belong in the tournament. This year is the worst argument for expanding the tournament I've ever seen. Watching some of these teams, I think they should contract the tournament back to 32 this season.
Half the teams that will be playing in the NCAA tournament will have to be satisfied with just one game there. But when that one game represents a school's first ever appearance at the event, should we say Portland State is the definition of just happy to be here?
I think they can expect an influx over the next 10 days of national college basketball writers like nothing you've ever seen. Interesting, Bill, there are only two schools which were eligible for the very first NCAA tournament who have never been. One is Northwestern and the other is William & Mary.
Mount St. Mary's of Connecticut is another team that should be on the list of just happy to be there, perhaps.
The Northeast Conference is a rocky conference. I suspect that St. Mary's will be one of the teams qualifying for that loathsome play-in game in Dayton, which they don't want you to call a play-in game, by the way, but that's exactly what it is, because they needed an extra space for one of the rat holes from the major conferences. They beat Sacred Heart pretty handily. They hadn't been in the tournament since 99, since Jim Phelan was coaching there. So, yes, they are slightly less happy to be there than Portland State, I'd say.
Meanwhile, in pro basketball, the Houston Rockets have completely forgotten how to lose. 21 consecutive wins ago, the Rockets were a relatively unimpressive 24-20. Should we now be regarding them as a serious championship contender?
I have spoken to several people who know more about the NBA than I do, and every one of them said this is the single most inexplicable event they have ever seen in their years of covering the league. This doesn't make any sense. Yao Ming went out, and they kept winning, and they can't be stopped now. You know, you've got Tracy McGrady, who people have heard of, and then you've got a bunch of guys, and you've got Dikembe Mutombo, who has rolled back the stone. Shane Battier, who looked like the living definition of an NBA journeyman, is scoring. I mean, this is absolutely implausible, and it's really one of the nicest things that's happened to the NBA in a long, long time.
I don't know if Roger Federer, the best player in the world, and Pete Sampras, who retired 6 years ago, took seriously the tennis match they played on Monday night and Tuesday morning. But the tickets went for $1,000 a pop, so some people certainly took it seriously. Should they have?
Well, they goofed around a little bit, and it was good for tennis. And you've got, you know, you had Pete Sampras cracking a smile, which was unprecedented as far as, you know, tennis people there. You had Tiger Woods in attendance. They goofed around with him. I mean, this is a kind of meeting of the ages, and Sampras is still young enough to run around out there without looking ridiculous. So, yeah, I think it was a good thing.
Bodie Miller, notorious for a training regimen and attitude that might be characterized as quirky, has won his second World Cup title in 4 years. He celebrated by telling reporters waiting at the bottom of the ski slope, "I'm not talking today." So have you anything to say about that?
Yes, good. I was sick of him the last time around. I'm more than a little sick of him now. Let him ski, let him win, let him fall off a mountain. I don't care about Bodie Miller anymore.
Miller's American teammate Lindsey Vonn won the women's title on Friday, Charlie. The U.S. hadn't swept in 25 years, so I guess we're looking at a U.S. skiing dynasty.
Yes, and who were the two people to do it the last time without looking?
Joe Pepitone.
There's your dynasty. Thank you very much.
Golfer John Daly, whose training regimen could only very charitably be described as quirky, lost his swing coach this week. Is this a dismaying development, or can Daly swing perfectly well without a coach?
John Daly took advantage of a rain delay to go to the Hooters hospitality tent, where they serve a lot of beer, and he proceeded to drink a lot of beer and meet a lot of women who wanted him to sign their pants. Butch Harmon found this insufficiently dedicated to the craft and let him go. But let me make a point that, for the record, that back in the good old days of the PGA Tour, John Daly would be utterly unremarkable in his attitude towards training regimen vis-a-vis social regimen. It's only now that golf finds this shocking. But I have no doubt that he is insufficiently dedicated for Butch Harmon.
I guess it really would have been a bad thing for the PGA if Daly had come off that rain delay and birdied every hole he had left to play.
I don't know. I think Butch Harmon might have taken credit for that.
Parents often misbehave at ball games in which their children are involved, but I don't think we've ever had to mention an ex-professional athlete in that context. Last Saturday, former Phillies closer Mitch Williams was tossed from his fifth-grade daughter's Catholic youth organization game. Why?
Can we bleep me? Can I say it, and can you bleep me? Mitch has since clarified events. Mitch was upset by the officiating in his daughter's Catholic youth organization game, so he is alleged to have called the referee a Now, he says no, he would never call a referee, especially in a Catholic youth organization game, a What he said was the call was and that clears it up.
I've heard about a lot of creative minor league baseball promotions, Charlie, but I have never seen a ball club rip a promotion out of the news and start advertising it any faster than the Makin' Music of the South Coast League did this week. Tell us what the music is planning for Elliot Spitzer Night at the Park.
I think we should drop in the Law and Order chunk chunk on this one, because you talk about rip from the headlines. This took less than 2 days. Some promotion guy is headed to the majors on the fast track. Anyway, on June 13th at Luther Williams Field, the Makin' Music will celebrate Elliot Spitzer Night. The ninth fan, or client number nine, which was Elliot Spitzer's nom de whoopee, will receive a free music prize pack. And then they'll play Frank Sinatra songs throughout the night, which I don't get at all. That's part of the story.
Will remain mysterious.
And they're going to place wiretaps all around the stadium.
Oh, how could anything go wrong? And finally, the notion that the golf course is an extension of the boardroom took a serious hit in South Korea this week. Charlie, what does the business world in South Korea have against golf?
They're playing too much golf, and the chances are they're not working hard enough. The president of South Korea starts work at 7:30 every morning as part of his deal, where he's going to be the hardest working president in showbiz, apparently. But if he doesn't think golf is hard work, he's never been out there with me. Let me tell you this right now. It's hard work.
I tee up various opportunities for Charlie Fierce each week here on Only a Game. When he's not here, he's writing for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Monday makes the weekend feel like it's a year away. Work is just a means to buy more time to play. I imagine God enjoyed the seventh day the best. Everyone deserves at least...
Retired Green Bay Packers quarterback Brett Favre has lots of fans, but my conversation about Mr. Favre's retirement on last week's program provoked some of his detractors to weigh in. Arlie Schmitz of Sioux City, Iowa, was unmoved by Favre's tears when he announced that his career was over. Address the crybaby part, she wrote. He cried like a little girl. How embarrassing. Ew, 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 jeez. Jason Nall, who hears Only a Game on WLRN in Miami, felt Charlie Pierce was on target in celebrating Brett Favre's durability. But, he wrote, media misleads and cheats their fans by failing to mention that Mr. Favre was caught and then admitted to abusing and being addicted to painkillers. I believe this is no better than baseball cheater Barry Bonds using HGH and steroids. In an email headed, Your Boorish NASCAR Bias, Deb Stallings chided Only a Game for what she termed passé mockery of NASCAR and its fans. She was unhappy when Charlie and I mentioned that the oil cover on Carl Edwards' car had fallen off, an event she feels we failed to understand or appreciate. The weight of the lid is entirely irrelevant, she wrote. It's the large improvement in aerodynamics that made the difference. Ms. Stallings closed her email with this injunction, get over your bias and let's go racing. In my conversation last week with Roger Abrams, the author of The Dark Side of the Diamond, Mr. Abrams discussed Jimmy Galvin, the major league pitcher who endured injections of animal testosterone in 1889. Tom Hanlon, who hears the program on WUSF in Tampa, emailed to contend that making a connection between that era's lack of understanding about drugs and present-day baseball players knowingly taking illegal drugs and then lying about it is a logical fallacy. You can respond to what you hear on the program by contacting us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Charles Faulkner, a Vermont listener, did that this week. Here's what he had to say.
You should cover the Arctic Winter Games in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories in Canada, with teams competing from Alaska, Canada, Greenland, Russia. This is high school age students from around the world, above approximately the Arctic Circle or something like that, and they have a great time together.
Why, thanks, Mr. Faulkner. That's a great suggestion. The idea for the Arctic Winter Games began in 1967 when some plucky Canadians noticed that athletes from north of the Arctic Circle were having trouble competing against their counterparts from relatively tropical sites further south in Canada. The first event was held in 1970 with 500 participants. This week, more than 2,000 athletes, coaches, officials, and cultural performers returned to Yellowknife to compete in everything from basketball and curling to the traditional game of finger-pulling. Kathy Bolstead, president of the 2008 Host Society, joins me on the line from Yellowknife. Kathy, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having us today.
Yellowknife, I assume, is not usually a terribly large and busy town. Describe how life has changed there over the past week or so.
Life has become amazing. I think we often talk about people coming out of the woodwork when spring comes, and you may know that we have had a very cold winter in Yellowknife, and people have been indoors with temperatures of minus 45 degrees Celsius, and so we had a heat wave. We're at about minus 20 today, and people have come out and are everywhere watching all kinds of sport and cultural activities.
Well, as I mentioned, the games were started to give Northern Canadians a chance to compete, but I understand that over the years, participation has grown well beyond Canada.
That's true. The games originally began with Alaska, the Yukon, and the Northwest Territories, the three contingents and about 500 participants. The games have grown significantly. We now have the participation of Greenland, of the Sami indigenous peoples of northern Scandinavia. So we have representation here from Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. We have northern Quebec, northern Alberta, and of course, we had a separation of the Northwest Territories in our Canadian history, so the new Nunavut Territory is also participating as well. So it's a real vast group of people here.
Just out of curiosity, if somebody from Miami or Tampa called up and said, we want to play too, what would you say?
Well, we'd tell them there's lots of room to play as volunteers. We have people that have come from a variety of places and are working in accommodations, are working as scorekeepers, are working as parking lot attendants. The games are an exciting thing, and a lot of people want to see the traditional Arctic sports of the Inuit people and the traditional Dene games of the Dene people in North America. And so they're a popular set of games.
Well, you better tell me something about those traditional games, because I'm one of the uninformed, so help me out with those games.
Well, the traditional games of the Aboriginal people are really based on survival on the land. So to give you an example, I might describe the knuckle hop. Not too many of us would envision being able to hold our bodies in a complete straight line on the toes and on our knuckles on a floor and hopping quite a distance. But these are survival skills of if you are out on the ice and you need to spread your body mass and get yourself to a safer zone. These were survival skills that people had. And so they're very much a part of the culture of the people that have lived in northern Canada and the circumpolar world. Our public broadcaster here, CBC North, is covering and carrying video of our games on their website.
Mm-hmm.
And they can see some of these at www.cbc.ca/north. And they can choose to watch the daily news there for television, which is covering the games every day. And they'll really get a snapshot of not just the traditional sports that many people know, but of the unique circumpolar sports from the Aboriginal people.
Assuming people are as excited by these sports as you think they will be if they check it out on your website, do you anticipate a boom in the population? Are we suddenly going to be seeing lots and lots of people moving north of the Arctic Circle?
I think we always have the challenge of the weather, and there are not a lot of people who want to live in minus 45 for a good number of months, but we certainly have had an influx of guests. The hotels are full here. I don't anticipate a lot of people will move here, but we'd certainly welcome them if they wanted to.
Well, I have to admit being confused by one headline that I read this week. It said, snowshoers win 9 ulus. What is an ulu?
Ah, An ulu is a traditional knife, if I can call it that. If you can picture cutting a piece of pie, it really is the curve of the outer part of the pie with a handle on top of it. Those were used to scrape the hides of animals that they would traditionally hunt for both food and clothing. And so in keeping with the traditions of the North and the importance of these cultural tools, rather than the traditional round silver, gold, and bronze medals, we have silver, gold, and bronze ulus.
The closing ceremonies will be tonight. Can you give me a little preview of the festivities that will be involved with that?
Well, the closing ceremonies are quite different than in the opening ceremonies. All of the contingents come in together in their color. It's a tradition in Arctic Winter Games that there is quite a swapping that goes on the last day. So as you can imagine, there will be a kaleidoscope of colorful jackets, but you won't know who's on what team because people will have bartered off and traded jackets. We have a francophone band. We have a nominee Aboriginal performing band. And, of course, as they head out and the skies darken, we will have a beautiful firework display here on Frame Lake.
Mm-hmm. I would think that trading jackets, I mean, taking your jacket off even for just the time it took to trade it would be risky in that weather, wouldn't it?
Not at all. This is a warm week for us. You know, I'm sure if you were to move here, you might be a little chilly in September when it got cold, but by spring you'd have acclimatized and you'd be used to this weather.
Kathy Volstad is the president of the Host Society for the 2008 Arctic Winter Games. Kathy, thank you very much for joining me.
You betcha. Have a great day.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We also had help this week from Steve Malagodi at WLRN in Miami and from Phil DiMartino. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from South of the Color Barrier author John Virtue, who tells a tale of automobile.
I listen to you every Saturday morning as I wash my car, and we live in a condo, and one of my fellow condo owners once said to me, if I believed in incarnation, I would come back as one of your cars.
Clean cars and sports radio recycled eternally. Sweet. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.